Oh, you.
What?
What's that? What's that? Oh.
It's all right, Min. It's just those noisy people in the tent upstairs. Who's that walking about upstairs?
I'm the famous Echo. I got friends in.
It's the famous Eccles and he's got friends in, Min. Do you mind taking those noisy boots off?
Okay.
Ah, that's better. Oh. I didn't know he had three legs, Henry.
He hasn't, Min, he hasn't. He has a one-legged friend. Good. Good night, Min.
Good night, buddy. Oh.
He's got two one-legged friends.
It's that or one three-legged friend.
Onto that, it was the 13th of November 1955.
Okay, so it was put out then a little bit before Christmas, so it's as close to a Christmas special as they ever got, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a Christmas Carol for series 10, which was very much Christmassy.
Have we started, by the way?
Do you know what? I've been rushed today, I've been working this morning, and what I normally do is I write a pithy little intro.
I see.
And it's usually, I'm trying to, you know, I try and...
Well, you can do it later.
I can try and tailor it to the show that we're doing. I haven't had a chance, so we may as well just crack on now, Andy.
Yeah, let's do it.
Andy Riley, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you.
And you are a very, is it Renaissance man, is that fair?
No, I can do about two things.
You can draw and you can write.
I'm a script writer of... comedy and a little bit of drama now as well, because you know you got to go where the work is, and also I'm a cartoonist and an author of children's books.
So
I mean, it's all related. I mean, I think I've known a lot of people in comedy who either are cartoonists or have done it in the past or have a great interest in comics or graphic novels. I mean, it's very, very common, really. I mean, so some reasonably well-known people. I mean, Charlie Brooker, he was a cartoonist. I think he stopped because it just takes fucking ages to do cartoons. Can I swear?
If you want.
Okay, it takes ages to do cartoons. I think Joel Morris did work with him. And I've worked with many people, Simon Pegg and Lenny Henry that I've worked with. They've written like graphic novels at various points or graphic novel stories. You know, Edgar Wright's adapted one. Dylan Moran's a pretty decent cartoonist. It's quite common.
Well, there's a great tradition of comedians that are also cartoonists, going back to, I'm thinking, Willie Rushton.
You know? Yeah, well, Bob Monkhouse,
yeah.
Really good cartoonist. I mean, when read his, I highly recommend his autobiography, Crying With Laughter.
You're the second person that's recommended that to me.
Yeah, it's absolutely excellent. I mean, I'd recommend that to any listener, even vaguely interested with the comedy of the 1950s, which, let's face it, you might be. It's nice to see it from the perspective of somebody who isn't like the Goons or Hancock. It's a slightly different take on the whole business. Plus, he has an absolutely extraordinary personal life, did Monkhouse. It mentions being a cartoonist. I never really thought much about it. And then a couple of years ago, I just by chance saw one of Bob Monkhouse's cartoons. And I thought, God, you were a brilliant cartoonist.
He was
a real Renaissance man.
He was an enormously talented man who got a lot of grief. Well, He was easily dismissed, wasn't he, for so long, and then he kind of had a bit of a renaissance in the mid-90s, didn't he?
It goes into that in the book, because he wrote the book in the 90s, yeah. And he realised that there was a whole generation of people, and I was one of them, I'm not sure how old you are, you may be, who didn't think of him as being a comedian at all. He was just a game show host.
Yeah.
And that's all we really
smarmy.
Knew.
Smarmy game show host.
Yeah, and he thought, no, I've got to do something about that. And he did a topical show, and I knew some people, Bob Monkhouse on the spot, I knew some people who wrote for it. Rob Colley wrote for that. And so it was, he did sort of cross over with my generation, although I never met the guy.
So when were you born, Andy?
I was born in 1970.
Okay, I'm 74. 1974. I'm not 74.
I thought, your voice sounds really young for a 74-year-old
yeah.
guy.
But yeah,
so I had to have a little think there.
We're more or less the same age, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, Monkhouse was just easily sort of brushed off as just being one of those record 20 in a day game show hosts, wasn't he?
Yes, well, he did do that, and he was fiendishly good at it because he had incredible recall for jokes.
But it's a skill in itself. It's a skill in itself, being able to churn out stuff like that.
Mm.
You mentioned Charlie Brooker there. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I was first exposed, for want of a better word, to Charlie Brooker's stuff, artwork, in Oink comic. Do you remember Oink?
Oh, I used to read Oink, yeah.
Yeah,
I loved Oink. Yeah, he just got the march on me because as a teenager, I thought, maybe I could draw for Oink when I grow up. Whereas he just sent stuff in.
Yeah, well,
maybe I should have, but I don't know. My stuff I wasn't ready at that time, I think.
Well, I grew up on a diet of Whizzer and Chips, Buster,
yes,
Whoopee, Jackpot. Not so much the Beano and the Dandy. It was more the Fleetway, the IPC.
Oh, I never liked the Dandy. Never liked the characters in it. Biffo the Bear, didn't care for him at all.
No,
really understand what the hell Desperate Dan was about. I mean, we'll get onto the Goon Show eventually, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
My 70s comic thing that I really liked that nobody remembers was Crazy.
Yes.
And its spin-off, Cheeky Weekly.
Crazy with a K.
Yeah, Crazy with a K. And there's actually quite a lot of Goon Show in especially Cheeky Weekly. You know, he was always sort of meeting characters that were sort of faintly like Bloodknock or Blue Bottle.
I suppose so, yeah.
And they'd do kind of a little bit of a joke, and then he'd go down the street and talk to some more. I've looked at some of that in recent years, and you can see the strands. You can see the linking material.
Well, the guys that wrote and drew those comics would have been, you know, they'd have come of age in the 50s, I guess.
Yes.
And I guess the world of, and I know, like you say, you've got many strings to your bow in terms of script writing as well and producing, but writing for children and drawing for children and sort of going around, I guess you go around a lot of schools and things like that and
it's an area of publishing in which you're actually encouraged to be funny, because there's actually not really a market, and this is weird, I don't quite understand how this happened, but there isn't quite a market for funny books for grown-ups. No one knows where to place them, even though, you know, people like P.G. Woodhouse and there are other funny authors who've done very well. I mean, sorry, say all the Discworld books, Terry Pratchett.
Well, Tom Sharp, I suppose.
Very funny books, yeah, but yeah. They're sort of, I don't know, maybe there was in the 70s, there sort of isn't quite a market for it now. And if you take in a book with jokes in, they kind of don't know what to do with it. Whereas if you approach children's publishing and go, I want to do a funny book with lots of jokes in, they're absolutely fine with that because they know how to market that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You explain it to me. I don't get it.
You must be happy, comfortable, because you have to perform, I guess, when you're in front of children, when you're...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I do. Just the other week, I did a gig at the Frinton-on-Sea Literary Festival. And you have to do a sort of an hour of stand-up as a children's author, which luckily, because I can draw like little characters quite quickly, I realised immediately that that's the best part of my act, is to draw from suggestions from the audience.
Yeah.
Because then that's like doing magic tricks. Because if you actually read out a bit of the book, everyone goes to sleep.
Yeah.
it's not really designed for that. And the ones that I do now are graphic novels, so I can't even do that. So There's a drawing is a big part of it. And of course, let's get to the Goon Show eventually. Is oh. that, you know, Spike Milligan is very much in this in this sort of vein of he sort of crossed over like cartoons and writing all the time, because his pictures were very well known, and I knew him as a kid from being a TV personality and the poems, and I'd see like his little cartoons every now and again, which always adorned the script books, of course.
Well, my introduction to Spike was, as a child, was Bad Jolly the Witch, the audio version.
Ah, right. Yes, yeah, I've never come across that. I know it's a thing he did, but it's not a thing I've ever looked at or anything.
It's wonderful, wonderful. It's just like a Goon Show for kids, you know, more so, if you like, with God in it.
Right.
God's a character.
Just then God came along, and when he saw what the wicked witch was going to do to Tim and Rose, he told the witch, go away.
No, I won't! I won't,
said the witch, and tried to scratch God's eyes out. So God pointed his finger at the witch and... The witch had burst like a bomb and disappeared in smoke, and her broomstick turned into a sky snake that flew up to the moon.
Okay, so the Goons, so... Yeah, so we've already established what age you are. So you, again, like many of my guests, I'm guessing, were probably introduced to the Goons through parents. Would that be
no,
right?
No. I wasn't really introduced to the Goons through anyone.
All right. Okay.
I know a lot of people get it from their, because I've listened to quite a few Goon pods. So a lot of people seem to get it from their dads on car journeys.
Yeah. That
seems to be very common. I do know where and when I first came across the Goons. Spike Milligan, I knew who he was, and this was because he was on TV a lot. He was a very famous guy, and I knew who Inspector Clouseau was, so I had some awareness of Peter Sellers, and Seacombe was around as well. But I knew there was this other thing called the Goon Show. I didn't know who was involved in it, but I knew it was a thing that grown-ups knew about. In the same way that I knew that there was a guy called, I'd heard of this guy called Monty Python, and and he was someone that grown-ups knew about, but I didn't really know who Monty Python was. You know what I mean? This is the kind of level we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
You think that Monty Python's a guy. And so 1978, I was 8 years old. Picture the scene. I was in Ramsgate on a summer holiday with my brother and my mum and my dad, and we were staying in this self-catering place in this square in Ramsgate. And... of course, you could get bored of an afternoon then, as a kid.
Well, in Ramsgate?
There was no telly on. We may not have even had a telly in the flat. I don't know. But you've read your Wizard and Ship summer special three times.
Mm.
You've got a transfer set. You've already been down to the beach today. So I started going through the books that happened to be in the flat. And, of course, there were some books in the toilet. And one of them was a Goon Show script book. Now, not only did I not know what the Goon Show was, I didn't know what format it was in. I didn't know that radio comedy existed, and I'd never seen a script before. So this was, I didn't know what I was looking at. So I thought, oh, Goon Show, great. I'll have a look at this, and I'll understand what it is the grown-ups know about. I didn't know what the hell I was looking at. I just thought there were these huge white spaces, and
that's right.
And characters' names in capitals, and then they'd be saying some sort of nonsense sentence, and I could not make head nor tail of it. And I thought, okay, well, the Goon Show's not for me. Whatever it is, I don't know.
I've got a sort of a self-imposed rule that I will never handle a book that's in someone else's toilet.
Right. Well, for those that don't know, I've done quite well out of toilet books, because I had two different... I did quite a lot of quite well-selling books in the noughties. The best-known ones being The Book of Bunny Suicides, and then its sequels, Return of the Bunny Suicides and Dawn of the Bunny Suicides. And those have found their way into lots of toilets all over the world. So toilet books have like paid for a good chunk of my house.
Wow.
I would not have the kitchen that I now have if it wasn't for toilet books. So I won't hear a word said against toilet
books. Here's me bad-mouthing them. I do apologise. Yeah. Proceed.
I mean, I take no responsibility for the hygiene of them, but...
No. But carry on. I interrupted you there.
Oh, sorry. So then I didn't really think about Goons the rest of the time. Got very into comedy as a teenager. And so if you're into comedy and you sort of go, well, who influenced who and where did it all come from? It takes you back to the Goon Show.
Yeah.
And I don't know quite when I started listening to it, but it was through tapes because that was how you could just come across it then. And I think when I was 18 and I went to university, I didn't really know what it was. And I do know that in 1991, when I was at the end of my university career, I had this puppet that I'd made out of a trowel called Cardinal Hardface. And I was doing a knockoff Major Bloodknock voice. And he was in a student show. Not a single person knew I was doing Major Bloodknock. No, this was at Oxford University.
Yeah.
And I was knocking about with my friends are really into comedy. None of them, I seem to recall, liked the Goon Show much at all. So I just sort of found it. And then it was a thing that I sort of knew about. And I'd never had a conversation about the Goon Show with anyone, really, until, about a year and a half ago.
Oh, really?
It just doesn't really come up very often.
But have you listened to them, the ones that exist? Have you listened to them all?
Yeah, I listened, not all of them, but I listened to loads of them back then, the ones that you could get.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of the better ones. So yes. You'd pretty quickly you get to Napoleon's Piano and the dreaded battered pudding Hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea. Mm. And my personal favourite, and the one I would have done on this podcast, had it not already been taken, was China Story.
Oh.
It's got my two favourite jokes in it, in the Goon Show. Also, I would have had to really tackle the racism head on. Because you can't do China Story without talking about that. And the my two favourite jokes in all of the Goon Shows are both in that show. And one of them is, as I walk through the docks of Shanghai, says Sea Goon, people seem to know I was British. Was it my hair, the cut of my suits, whatever? Was it the 6-foot floodlit Union Jack tied to my head? And that always really stayed with me because I'm going to get onto this because I've got a historical digression that I'm going to try and spring on you on this show.
Good.
But it's about Milligan's relationship with patriotism. Because he seemed to always, and this runs all through his work, he seemed to regard characters who are flying oversized Union Jacks or standing next to oversized Union Jacks as being intrinsically ridiculous.
which let's be fair, they are.
Which they are. So whenever I see a government minister with a 6-foot Union Jack in their office that they're ostentatiously sitting next to, I think of China Story and I think of Nettie Segal. And the other one pretty much every Goon Show has a bit where the joke is that something goes on for too long.
Oh, yeah.
That's Milligan's construction. I don't know if he invented it, but he certainly perfected it.
Yeah.
And so that's the one where Sea Goon has to go, for those that don't know, Sea Goon has to go and find a secret tea house called the Tea House of the August Goon. And there's a secret knock to get in. And the secret knock is that you knock 5,000 times. Yeah. So he knocks 5,000 times, or for very great knocks. And then he's out of breath. The door opens. Tea House of the August Goon? No. Bang, the door shuts in his face. And then he has to do it again. And the whole thing lasts about a minute. And I must confess that in my film that I wrote in 2020, 2021, which was filmed last year and will be out next year, it's called Seize Them. It's a medieval comedy.
Oh, right.
Tell you more about that later.
Yes.
I realised retrospectively that I used this construction more than once. The joke that goes on for too long. I really indulged myself on that because... as a scriptwriter, you can't always get away with it. If you're a writer-performer, you can kind of enforce it. You can enforce surrealism and oddness.
But that sort of repetition or that dragging things out, I mean, I'm just thinking of an exponent of that in modern times. Stuart Lee is a master of that, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And also the... If I had to prove to anyone how much the Pythons got from the Goon Show, Exhibit A would be the Camelot song from Holy Grail and the bit in, I don't know what Goon Show it is, about joining the Navy.
Oh, that's Dishonored.
Yeah, it's the same joke.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same joke with a little bit moved around. It's a real like cover version, pretty much.
Well, I mean, in this show we're talking about today, there's one of those.
We should get to it in the end, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you discovered the goons on your own.
Yes. Then I started writing radio comedy.
Yeah.
So in the autumn of 1991, me and Kevin Cecil, my writing partner, we were sort of banging on the door of BBC Radio, and then weirdly they let you in at that time. You could just walk in off the street.
Yeah.
And write for Weekending, the radio show. Doesn't mean you'd get anything on. But you could go and pitch things directly to a producer just having walked in off the street, which seems amazing now. But yeah, that's how a lot of us got started on that particular show.
So would you have met Dirk Maggs then around that time?
Dirk Maggs, I knew a little bit because he didn't produce Weekending while I was on it. They used to rotate producers. But he was one of the producers on the corridor. And yeah. I made it my business to kind of meet them all at some point or another.
Uh-huh.
Don't know him well, but yes, I do know him, and he was around at that time and doing really good stuff.
Yeah.
And was really at the forefront of doing kind of action radio, which was then he was like the only guy doing it. Action adventure radio with big sound effects.
Well, and also obviously he was spearheading the Goons 40th anniversary radio season.
Yes.
If you want to call it that, in 91.
Yeah, and I was really, then I listened to a lot of it.
Yeah,
and that was probably about like Christmas of 91. So we were just starting off then. And because I've been listening to the Goons a lot for the last few years and I was starting to write for the radio, I kind of regarded the Goons show as, we were never trying to copy it because you can't copy it. It's impossible. But I just sort of thought, well, this is Milligan was like Willy Wonka, you know, here's your world of pure imagination that opens up to you.
Yeah.
And it was around that time that I reread I read all the war diaries and I read Pakun, and really sort of got my way around the oeuvre. I did really like his last. I was just old enough to catch his last BBC series though, which was There's a Lot of It About.
Oh yeah.
However, why don't we start talking about the thing? Because I can guess about all these things all day, but I feel at some point, so you can have some sort of afternoon, I should start talking about the International Christmas Pudding.
What was it about this particular show? Because I know you said it's not your favourite, China Story is, but is this essentially your second favourite?
I don't know. It's certainly got some great jokes in it that I really like. But they tend to be once it gets going. The weird thing about this one is, I think it is a very good Goon show. It doesn't start well. It's got a very weird beginning. It starts with this voiceover, sort of. I think it's Sellers explaining it, but it's not one of the regular characters. It's just a sort of a dark brown voice explaining the rough setup of this episode.
Many years ago, in the year 562 BC, the great monumental international Christmas pudding was struck by lightning, which also struck a tree. And the magnificent international Christmas pudding, which had been erected by Sissy Gambus atop a temple tall, was broken into two portions by the knock it received during the fall. And oh, these portions have been carried to a far corner of the earth, and this terrible disaster is not an occasion for mirth, and oh.
Now, this is a funny little bit here, because clearly this is a bit of a joke, that this is a Christmas pudding, yet it existed before Christmas, right?
Yeah,
562 BC.
It's true. I never thought of that. Yes.
However, there's no laugh point to that gag, and there's one or two funny little ideas in this episode. There's another one later on that really struck me as well, where it's a really interesting little idea. That's the kind of thing that you spot on a second listen, and it's what makes this sort of stuff very interesting to comedy writers because it's dense.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some big whacka whacka puns in it, but it's also just got these puzzling ideas that you go, what did he mean there? What did he say? And that I think is one of them. And then it goes into a parliamentary discussion, and around this time, I think I have been listening to some of the shows in order on Spotify. And I've noticed that at this point, at 55, 56, they do seem to be interested in the House of Commons.
Oh yeah,
and so you get these kind of like weird House of Commons debates, all where everyone is like half asleep or doesn't really understand what's going on. And so it's, we're a few minutes in now, and we haven't really had any of the normal characters. And that's what makes it slightly odd. And so this voice in Parliament says, if the International Christmas Pudding can be reassembled, and this is set in the year 1843 AD.
Same year as the publication of A Christmas Carol.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Or is that coincidence or not?
I don't know. Carry on.
Anyway, in the probably is because there's no mention of it in this. This old doddery MP says that if the different parts of the International Christmas Pudding can be reassembled, it will be, and I quote, a turning point in the falling prestige of this wonderful country of ours. And then someone shouts tea up, and they all go and get tea. So. When I listened to this a few months ago and I started thinking about the phrase British prestige, and this is where I'm going to go on to a bit of a digression.
Fine.
But about the nature of it's a historical reading of this episode from an imperialist, a post-imperialist point of view, which I promise you will loop back to the war experience of the goons themselves.
Yeah.
So British prestige, and I have a subscription to the British Newspaper Archive, which if a bit of a history nerd like me is tremendous. Mm. Because it's searchable. You can search a phrase across hundreds of thousands of newspapers, and you can kind of track how that phrase was used over the time. So I did British prestige, and it was really fascinating, because the phrase had been around since Victorian times, and it's something that people used to really, really worry about. It was tremendously important to the country, to the point where people would say that it's worth fighting wars in order to maintain British prestige. This is from the Yorkshire Post and Leeds Intelligencer in 1885. And it's a small news item. It says, Indian feeling on the British surrender. A Times Calcutta telegram in the second edition says the arrangement with Russia has created a feeling approaching dismay. The proposed settlement is considered dangerous and humiliating. All accounts in the Northwest Provinces and Afghanistan agree that ministerial vacillation is ruining British prestige. And you get loads of these.
Yeah.
It's people examined prestige like a weather forecast. They were always worried about it going up or going down. People in Parliament would say that British prestige has never been higher. Other people would say British prestige has never been lower. And they would say that even in the late Victorian
period. So they cared about what other people thought of them, other countries.
Very much so, very much so. And this was the phrase, prestige, British prestige. And if you look for a definition, I found a couple of interesting ones from the 1920s. One is respect tinged with fear.
Right.
That's okay.
Speaks volumes.
That's it's a combination of soft power and hard power. There's a letter to the Westminster Gazette in 1925 where someone is describing something that happened to them last night. And he says, last night I listened to a layman who sought to prove that British prestige is on the wane. Interpreting prestige as power, the power to bring or to threaten to bring the mailed fist into operation whenever necessary, he deplored the reduction of our forces since 1918 and attacked the Washington Conference for the limitation of warships. Now, that is a very gung-ho definition of prestige. Mm. That's all about force and power. So that's before this First World War, and then it's a bit slippery between the wars, and then after the Second World War, everything changes. Because the old-fashioned British prestige was about, which is about economic and military might, is gone. And that game is up and everyone knows it. The phrase British prestige survives, but we are finding prestige in gimmicky things. So there's a few from 1955. In the Dundee Courier, Mr. Donald Campbell has done it again. He's broken his own world speed record by travelling at 260 miles an hour on a lake in the American state of Nevada. Mr. Campbell's feat will give British prestige a valuable boost over there. So we can't threaten people with warships anymore.
No.
But we've got a fast boat. also from 1955 in the Illustrated Sporting and Dramatic News, British ploughmen lead the world. British prestige in Scandinavia, already high in many spheres, was further enhanced in farming when teams from Great Britain and Northern Ireland won four out of the first six places in the World Ploughing Championship. So the best one of all is from 1955 again, and it's about a dog.
Right.
This is in the Ashbourne Telegraph. Ashbourne bred dog helps British prestige. And it is telling us that because this dog, a British dog, has gone to a dog show in Rio de Janeiro, it's of great national importance. It is reported that due to recent exports of this type of animal, British prestige is as high as it can be in Brazilian dog circles.
Ooh, so what a come down from empire.
Yeah, isn't it? So I think that this phrase, which was in common circulation really up until the 1960s, and certainly in the early part of Milligan's life, has kind of shifted, and I think he knows it.
Yes.
So this is why the searching for British prestige in this episode is something as gimmicky as looking for the international Christmas pudding, because that's the sort of thing that people were trying to get British prestige from at this point. So I think it's not just silly and daft. I think there is something broadly satirical going on here.
Well, this is just pre-Suez, of course.
It's just pre-Suez, but everything's on the slide, because yeah. Britain is decolonializing all over the place, and Suez is sort of like a last hurrah attempt to be a major world power.
Without getting too political or anything, but do you think that these days Britain doesn't really care about what other countries think of it? There's that feeling of prestige is even more watered down.
Well, I think Brexit kind of looked both ways on that one. So to some extent, it was, we are a big, important power. We're the seventh biggest economy in the world. You know, we can do what we like. We're a buccaneering nation. I've got to hate that word, buccaneering.
Yeah.
To keep using. As if, you know, we're sliding down a sail with a knife, with another knife between our teeth, you know, all that kind of crap. And also it was a sort of a pulling up of the drawbridge and going, well, you know, fuck you all. I don't care what you think, I'm British. There was a lot of sort of major blood knockism in the whole thing, was there not? but it still is a thing. I mean, the government ministers, certainly Boris Johnson, love to say world beating.
That's true.
World beating response to COVID.
That's true.
I think in the Blair years, Blair was keenly aware of this kind of stuff. And they were finding British prestige in British music or, you know, British art, because it was felt that, you know, Britain was a bit of an artistic powerhouse in the 90s, because we could cut a sheep in half. We could cut a sheep in half and put it in a tank. And that was British prestige. One more thing to say about it.
Yeah.
And this is to bring it back to the goons.
Yeah.
Is that there is a reading of the situation in North Africa in the Second World War, which is that the commonly accepted reason why Britain was fighting in North Africa at all was to protect the Suez Canal and keep the Suez Canal open as a trade route. And that's why Seacombe was there, and that's why Milligan was there.
Yeah.
Sellers was in Asia, was he not? I don't know.
Yeah, India, yeah.
But certainly two of the goons were. I don't know where Benteen was. But there is a reading of this which says that wasn't really the case at all. There's A.J.B. Taylor, the historian.
Yeah.
He believes, and I'll quote this. I don't know what book it's from, but I've got the thing here. When France fell out of the war, there were short-lived doubts whether the British could hold the Mediterranean and Egypt by themselves. On 16th June 1940, Sir Dudley Pound, the first Sea Lord, suggested to Sir Andrew Cunningham, the naval commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean, that he should block the Suez Canal and withdraw the bulk of his fleet to Gibraltar and the rest to Aden. Cunningham disliked this as a further blow to British prestige. Pound did not insist, and the question of remaining in the eastern Mediterranean was never formally discussed by either the chiefs of staff or the war cabinet. Now, this suggests that everyone just sort of agreed that Britain just had to hold the Mediterranean just because you had to. That there wasn't actually a military objective in the way that there was in, say, D-Day, or the war in the North Atlantic, which is about maintaining supply routes. Britain wasn't really supplying itself through the Suez Canal at all. It was rerouting ships past the Cape of Good Hope, so going south of Africa, and the Atlantic Sea routes were much, much more important. So why was Britain fighting in North Africa at all? Why was Milligan manning a gun in Algeria? British prestige.
Well, you think about wars that Britain entered or instigated or was part of that were pointless. I mean, you could argue the First World War in many ways was... What was that for? What was that about?
It's not immediately obvious, is it?
No, but then there's... I know Britain went to war over somebody's ear, didn't they?
Oh, the War of Jenkins' Ear. Yeah. Well, that's more just because they were having like ongoing fights with the Spanish, I think, on that one. I'm pretty sure it was against the Spanish. I did study it at university. It was a long time ago. But yeah, it's because a captain got his ear cut off. Again, that's British prestige.
Mm-hmm.
Saving it's all face. About, well, we can't... We just can't have... Literally saving face. Well, at least the side of it. we just can't have people cutting off the ears of our captains. Sometimes there isn't an objective exactly, other than the overarching message to the world of showing that we mean business.
Absolutely.
And they can't screw with us. But the actual outcome of an individual war is serving that objective. So these things are a lot less well worked out than you think. Now, we're turning to the motivations of the characters in International Christmas Pudding. They are all going off, or at least Seagoon is, at Gritpipe Thin and Moriarty's instigation, to go and capture the at least one of the parts of the International Christmas Pudding for Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the characters are self-serving. There's no sense in this imperialistic adventure that anyone isn't venal or corrupt.
If only all these fragments of the great International Christmas Pudding could be found and reassembled under one roof, the whole magnificent structure could be completely restored. What an incentive to goodwill and understanding among men.
Dad!
Yes.
How would... And think carefully.
Yes?
How would you like to join my great International Christmas Pudding exhibition?
Yes!
No, though. I doubt if you have the stamina.
What? A test! A test! Give me a test!
Lift me on your back.
Child's play. Put your foot in. And there!
Good. Now, Moriarty.
Easy. Watch out for the tennis friend there. Now what?
You sure you've got money?
Yes, of course I have.
Then the Ritz-Carlton grill for lunch. And step on it, please, do you mind?
Gritpipe Thin and Moriarty, surprise, surprise, at the end, are doing it not for Britain, but just to get themselves rich. And they're tricking Seagoon, which is kind of every Goon Show story, let's face it, that they're bamboozling Seagoon in some way.
Well, this episode is interesting, actually, because you mentioned Gritpipe and Moriarty, because Milligan loved the sodden, matted underbelly of humanity, if you like. And no characters in the Goon Show, I think, personify that more than Gritpipe and Moriarty. Particularly in the later series, where they both of them are totally wretched. They're on their uppers, you know. They're looking, you know, they're sharing the same suit, for example. You know, they're eating newspaper. But this, up until this point in the show's history, Gritpipe would be, in some cases, for example, you know, a commander or a, you know, in some position of authority.
Yeah.
And Moriarty himself was, you know, his colleague. And, you know, there was no suggestion that they were in any sort of penury. But this show, International Christmas Pudding, really is the first instance where we've got them as desperate men. Desperate to the extent that they're even thinking of cannibalism at one point.
You know? Oh, that's right. When we find them, they're so broke that they try and trick Seagoon into going into an oven.
Yeah.
You see, what I've never really been up on, but I'm starting to learn a little bit about now, is the order of the shows and how things developed. Because when I used to get the cassettes, of course, I didn't even know when you know what order things were in. I didn't worry too much about the continuity.
Mm.
But now I'm listening to them a little bit in order. I'm starting to pick up a few things. So, yeah, I think I have been... I've not really taken that in, but what you've said. But now you point it out. Yes, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. Also, Bloodnock is just wants as much money as he can get. Blue Bottle just is exactly the same, but he just wants sweets. But he's essentially got the same motivations as almost everyone else. Seagoon is just a bored, rich gentleman adventurer. He seems to be doing it for a laugh. So no one involved in this pudding thing is doing it for any noble reason. And it's a Victorian imperial adventure. So this is, Milligan's quite clear about the motivations for making an empire. He comes from the Raj, but I don't think there's any doubt in his mind about what put the Raj there. It was greed.
Absolutely. And I don't think any of the characters in the Goon Show ever have approached any task or undertaking with noble intentions.
Yes. I mean, some of them are at least not as evil as others. Obviously, Eccles.
True.
Because he's too thick to really understand what's going on.
True.
But he's not exactly helping people, is he? No. It's a bleak view of the world.
If you boil the Goon Show down to its constituent parts, a lot of it is explosions, people dying, literally. Yes. In the case, well, not literally, but obviously Blue Bottle every episode virtually.
Yeah.
Poverty. Blackmail. Very often Neddy is
swindling.
Swindling. That will do.
From poverty.
There's never anything honourable going on in the Goon Show, is there?
Yeah. But it's, I think this is where what you need to make this thing work is the performance of Harry Seacombe, which Absolutely. Is so warm that the show feels warm.
Yes.
And that is what emotionally takes you through, because that is such a warm, lovable voice. And the Seagoon's my favourite character by a mile.
Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. I mean, is that unusual for people to say that? Because I know that's a frequent question.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. When I think of characters in the Goon Show, I almost don't include Seagoon. I don't know why, because he's the base, if you that every other character
I know,
is built upon.
I know, because you sort of think of the other ones, but increasingly I think, no, actually, it's him.
Yes.
And of course, it gets a little ignored just how good his performance is across every Goon Show, because in all the years since, and at the time, but especially since, people will talk about this twin genius situation where you've got Sellers and you've got Milligan, like having Paul McCartney and John Lennon in the same band, and it used to obscure how good, say, Ringo Starr was when people talked about the Beatles. I think that's changed now. I think people have figured out just what a good drummer he was, such a creative drummer. But I think because Sellers and Milligan have always attracted so much attention, it's easy to forget how good Seacombe is.
Yeah.
And why? And so he was two really egotistical guys, right?
Yeah.
Sellers and Milligan. They weren't shy about pushing themselves forward. So why did they want this other guy to be the main character? Because they could see how good he was.
Yeah. So many of these are boys' own adventure type stories, aren't they? Which always have a, quote, heroic central character. And although Neddy is very rarely heroic, he's the character around whom the other characters gravitate. They are all in his orbit.
Yes, and also, if he's dealing with, say, Bloodknock or Grippipe Thin or Moriarty or Blue Bottle, they are morally worse than he is.
So yes.
He looks. I mean, and pretty much everyone except Eccles is morally worse than Seagoon. So he shines a little brighter. But to show you how good he was, right? In this show, there are two Flubs lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And one of them is Sellers Flubs it. And he says the word exhibition instead of expedition.
Yeah.
And he just skates past it. I think he realizes he did it, but didn't get anything out of it. Seacombe flubs a line somewhere around the middle of the show, gets a really good laugh out of it. Straight away, he knows what he's done wrong. And he gets a joke out of it. And you, like, in a second.
Yes.
And you think, God, that's good. It's so clever to have done that.
The Naringi Berbers have captured the last pudding of the International Christmas Pudding portion. Well, you know what I mean, don't you, Gridpine? Anyway, they've had a go at it.
And again, that's the sort of thing that people don't notice so much about Seacombe, because certainly for our generation, we knew him from like, oh God, what was the show? Highway, that he was on, which is not exactly a big comedy number. It was a sort of a Christian-ish magazine program. What the hell was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was a religious. It was in that sort of what do you call it? Songs of Praise slot, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it wasn't exactly showcasing him as a comic genius. Oh, here's another magical moment that he does that I think predicts Mac Berry by half a century.
Right. Okay.
We're jumping around in the story here, but for those unfamiliar, Seagoon is off trying to catch a Christmas pudding, which is some sort of sentient monster roaming the jungles.
Yeah, it's
of
not quite sure what it is, but
Yingtong Idolai Po. Yeah, it's some kind of live thing, and he's got to catch it. It's like a big tiger hunt, really.
Mm.
So he says to Bloodnock at one point, in order to catch this pudding, just after they've seen it, he says, "We must dig a pudding pit and line the sides with custard." It's a really good laugh because didn't say custard. He said custard. And who knows, I don't know, whether or not that was something he did in the moment or not. But now I've written like the entire series for Matt Berry.
Yeah.
So we did Year of the Rabbit on Channel 4. We had one series of that broadcast. We were about to film the second one. We wrote the whole thing, and then it got killed by COVID.
Right.
So I've worked quite closely with Matt.
I love.
And so you write the script as you would for anyone, but you know that there's going to be some words where, particularly on a feed line, or a line which wouldn't normally be that funny because you've just got to get over a piece of information, he will just throw in a completely bonkers sort of pronunciation and put the weight on the wrong thing altogether.
"We must dig a pudding pit and line the sides with custard so it can't climb out."
Brilliant, lad, brilliant.
With the custard, I just think, is that because Harry instinctively felt that there weren't a lot of laughs in this little bit, so he just thought, I'll just, you know, because he's got a lot in the bank of audience warmth, hasn't he, that he can draw on. And he just felt, I'll just pronounce it a different way just to get a cheap laugh.
I think so, because I think over the episode, the bits which are about the puddingness of the pudding, they're not really carrying it. So I think it's exactly that. He thinks, oh, okay, I'll just throw that at the end and I'll enhance the laugh. And actually, that's how good he is. I mean, this is my guess, but whether or not he thought it up in the moment or earlier, it's brilliant either way. The delivery is utterly perfect. I think as well we should talk about the big set piece of the episode, which is, this is one of the other reasons why I really wanted to do this one.
Yeah.
And it is when Henry and Minnie are in a tent.
Yes. So
they were on a different exhibition. I almost did what Sellers did. Expedition in Africa to find moss. Really, it's just an excuse to get Henry and Minnie in the middle section of the show.
Yeah.
And they... there is some clumping around, and it's the tent upstairs. Now, this is, isn't that great? That's proper.
That's a proper joke.
That's proper, where you just change the mental picture with one thing in a way you can only do on radio. It's just perfect stuff.
Yep.
And Eccles is upstairs. and he's clumping around, and he's stopping them from sleeping. So they ask him to take his boots off. So he takes off two boots. And then just as Minnie is saying, "That's better," a third boot drops. And it's perfectly timed. And and suddenly, again, a little sound effect, you've completely changed the mental picture. Well, Eccles has got three legs. I mean, in the world of the Goon Show, this is entirely possible. So then it's like, well, is he got a one-legged friend? Or has he got two one-legged friends? Or does he have three legs? So this is insane conversation between Henry Crun and Minnie Bannister. Which I think it's one of those ones that for me really settles it that it is a sexual relationship. I know this is a debate that has been had on Goon Pod.
Yeah.
But she calls him Naughty Henry here. And they're tucked up in bed together.
That's true.
I think they're a couple.
Can I just mention about that sequence?
Yes.
Because I was listening. Obviously, I've listened to this show many, many, many times over the years, but I haven't listened to it for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
And I listened to it the other night preparing for this, and I was jolted. I don't mind telling you, Andy. But jolted by memory, listening to the Minnie and Henry sequence, because I've always said that the first time I ever heard the Goons was when New Zealand National Radio played the last Smoking Sea Goon.
Yeah.
And that was the last proper Goon show, actually, but it was the first one I heard. And I've always said that. But do you know what? I think it's the Minnie and Henry sequence from the International Christmas Pudding that I heard before that, because either my mother or my father, in the house, there was a tape called the BBC Comedy Special. And I've looked it up online, and it was released in 1977, I think, in Australia. So I think it's like an Australasian compilation of BBC comedy, mainly radio comedy. But there was that sequence for Minnie and Henry. And also, I mean, it had like clips from Fawlty Towers, Round the Horn, the Rent-A-Chap sketch from Round the Horn.
Yeah.
Had Gerald Hoffnung, Tyrolean Landlords. It had even had Noel Edmonds on his Radio 1 breakfast show, a spoof phone call to some listener. Anyway, but the Minnie and Henry sequence from International Christmas Pudding, it just kind of came to me in a flash of insight. I thought, no, I heard that first before I heard an actual Goon show.
I mean, you can see why it got snipped out and used, because I think it's one of those bits that does work as a sketch.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a nice little standalone. I mean, obviously, it's the one that gets pulled out most is What Time Is It, Eccles.
Yes, yes.
Which I'm over the years, I've become slightly tired of. I think there's more to it. There's more to it than that. And also, here's the thing. My favourite character of the main group is, I haven't got a ranking exactly, but Seagoon, first of all, I think after that, possibly Grip Pipe Thin or Henry Crun. Bottom of the main regular characters, Blue Bottle.
Oh.
I don't find Blue Bottle very funny.
Hmm.
And I know I'm supposed to, certainly the audience in the theatre would heartily disagree with me on this.
Yeah.
Particularly in this episode. Because of course, sometimes, depending on how he's introduced or the mood of the room, Blue Bottle gets a cheer, and other times he doesn't. You know, hence, you know, waiting for audience applause, not a sausage. This episode is one of the ones where, yay, they're really pleased that Blue Bottle's arrived. For me, I go, the episode's tailing off now. And it's just personal. I just find other characters. I don't dislike Blue Bottle, but I don't find him anything like as funny as the rest of them. I don't know why. Is that common? You've talked to a lot of people about this.
Yeah, I've had a few people say that. I really do like Blue Bottle, but I do think you can judge Sellers' mood during the recording based on his portrayal of Blue Bottle.
Yeah.
Because sometimes he puts, there's real oomph, there's real, Blue Bottle's got real sort of, just sounds fully rounded, and sometimes it sounds like Sellers is just phoning him in.
Maybe it's to do with like how well Blue Bottle is received on that first thing.
Maybe. Yeah.
Certainly on this one, this is a good Blue Bottle. He's high power Blue Bottle in this.
Yes.
And he has a really good bit about how pleased he is that he's going to have some jelly babies as payment for being a scout. And it's going to make him a man of wealth and mystery at school. And it's a good Blue Bottle bit. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good Blue Bottle bit, but I think he's full throttle Blue Bottle.
He's always jealous of other people. He always has to have one over on other people at school. In this case, Harold Lane with his Tony Curtis-style haircut.
Blue Bottle led us to the great mud wall city of Aystacton.
Yes, there it is, Captain. Now for my reward.
Here, then, is your quarter of jelly babies.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. These jelly babies will increase my power of influence at school. This will make Molly Nasher think twice about me at playtime. Thinks again. I know. I will taunt her with my jelly babies. I will be a man of wealth and mystery. I'll make her forget about that rotten swine Harold Lane and his Tony Curtis type haircut.
I think, you know, sometimes I feel, and having listened to some recently, on Sellers' off days, his characters start to sound a bit more alike than they could, I think. And this sort of, I think there's a sort of a vocal crossover between Henry Crumb and Blue Bottle. So then I thought, oh, maybe I should get a fan theory about this. They're actually the same character. That Henry Curran is just a much older Blue Bottle. He's travelled back in time.
Wow.
And hasn't ever told Blue Bottle that he is the older Blue Bottle. So, you know, we're in Back to the Future where... God, what's his face? What's the name of the baddie?
Biff.
Biff Tannen. Yeah, where older Biff Tannen meets younger Biff Tannen. Older Biff Tannen doesn't say, I'm you from the future. The younger Biff Tannen just thinks he's an old guy.
Doesn't he just call him a meathead or something?
Something like that, yes. Yeah. But he certainly doesn't let on that he's from the future.
That's true.
So what if Henry Crone is the older Blue Bottle? I have nothing to back it up, other than the fact that they sound similar.
Yes.
So I'm going to float that. I'm going to put that up the flagpole.
All right.
And see if anyone thinks there's anything that has any value whatsoever.
I want to talk about it's a good opportunity to talk about Sellers' performance in this show. Okay, because an interesting thing happened during the recording of this show.
Oh.
Sellers was fired, believe it or not.
When? Before the show? During the show?
I think, well, it's unclear. Okay, so Peter Easton, the producer.
Yeah.
Now, I've listened to this show so many times, and I can't work out what the problem is. But basically, during the first act, pre-Max Galdray.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Easton was furious with Sellers because, Peter Easton said we were recording and Sellers did something which put Harry off.
Yeah.
In the Max Galdray number, I went behind and told him to stick to the script. We went back for the middle spot and he started fooling about again. And I said, if you do that again, I'll fire you. He thought I wouldn't dare. So he did it again. So I had to fire him. Later, he came back and apologised.
The fuck? So it happens during the show?
Yeah, now.
That's unbelievable.
Now.
Wow.
Andrew Pixley, who's founder of All Knowledge, these sort of things, and he wrote the booklets for the Goon Show Compendium releases, and he talks about this, and also Roger Lewis in The Life and Death of Peter Sellers mentions it. But... I checked with Andrew Pixley actually yesterday, and he couldn't give me any more sort of information. We don't, because Roger Lewis himself doesn't know what exactly Sellers said or did that caused all this. So it's a little bit unclear. But Sellers apologised and it was kind of forgotten about. But there were some letters exchanged between Sellers via his agent and Patrick Hilliard, who was head of Variety for the BBC. A couple of days after, and Sellers basically digging his heels in and saying, I accept that Peter Easton was unhappy, but you know, I don't think I did anything wrong, but you know, let's forget about it, kind of thing. It was that kind of tone. And Patrick Hilliard sent a reply to this letter from Sellers saying, dear Peter, with regard to the Goon Show incident last Sunday, Peter Easton has fully reported to me what took place, and whilst you have explained that the attitude you took when Peter commented on your opening scene was due to matters not in any way relating to the show, I take the gravest view of your refusal to re-record the opening spot. I think it harmful enough to the show for an artist to give a performance below standard, but to absolutely refuse to remedy this is unbelievable behaviour for a professional of your standing. I have already had adverse comments on this particular program from the Home Service, who were quite unaware of the incident, and this distresses me very much.
Wow.
Please do not think that I failed to appreciate the great contribution you've made to the success of the Goons, and that there can be many differences where so many personalities are involved. This is perhaps why I'm all the more surprised to have had this report, but I must ask you to give me an assurance that this sort of thing will not happen again. Sincerely yours, etc., etc.
Wow.
And I won't read the reply that Sellers sent, but basically he kind of doesn't really accept it. And he says at the end of his letter, "In passing, I'd like to add, we had in the audience last Sunday a very well-known actor-producer who is an ardent Goon fan, and he happened to mention that he thought it was the best show in the present series."
Wow.
So that's Sellers basically saying, well, we had someone in the audience who thought it was great, so
yes,
up yours, kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, this then possibly explains the very high-energy blue bottle at the end.
Maybe.
He's showing you what he can do. He's saying you can't fire me because I can do this.
But I don't know what Harry... apparently he threw Harry in the first act. I don't know what... I can't...
Hang on, let me look at my notes and see. It's in the first act that he flubs a line and it's the exposition, the exhibition...
Yes.
Expedition thing. So that is surely part of it.
They said, can you re-record that? And he refused.
Yeah, I mean, that is the uncorrected error in this.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But other than that, you can't really tell.
No.
But I had no idea it was that tempestuous. You can make an entire show just about what's going on behind the scenes here. Any indication of what Milligan thought while all this was going on?
No, nothing. Wow. Nothing.
Okay. That's unusual to think, well, he wouldn't have something to say. Not get involved in an argument.
I imagine... I mean, 10 years later, with Sellers, where Sellers' career was 10 years after this, he would have done a walk. He would have walked off. He would have had a big massive strop and refused to ever darken the doorway of the Camden Theatre again.
Wow! You know?
But I don't say that he accepted what Peter Eaton said necessarily, but he didn't protest too much either.
Yes.
Also, I interviewed last year, it's not been actually released yet for various reasons, but I interviewed the audio engineer Ted Kendall. Mm-hmm. Do you know about Ted Kendall?
No, I don't.
He's the guy, genius audio engineer, who restored most of the existing Goon shows for the Goon Show Compendium and cleaned them up and put back in stuff that had been removed by transcription service. And restored as many Goon shows to their original broadcast length and to the best sort of digital quality that he possibly could. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's him we have to thank. And they wanted to put out a Goon show for Christmas 87. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop into this episode that little brief bit of Ted talking about that.
Around about 86, 87 could have been. Somebody decided to have a bit of a policy at Radio 4. They do it from time to time, you see. And it was to the effect that comedy shows in particular were, after editing, were coming out rather too short and announcers were having to do a lot of fill. So the edict went out that for a 30-minute slot, the programme had to run at least 29 minutes 15, or for every 5 seconds it underran, £100 would be taken off the programme budget. Now, of course, to a producer, there's nothing like a monetary incentive. So when Richard Edis was given the job of selecting a Goon show for that year, and it turned out to be the International Christmas Pudding, the first thing that happened was he got sent the Pick of the Goons, 27-minute version. And he came back and said, well... And that's 27 minutes. Got a bit of a problem with that, which he explained, and that got thrown to me as the Goon Man. And it was one of those instances where I was able to say, well, it just so happens that I have about me a tape copy of the original TS issue. So straight off the bat, I was able to reinstate most of the script just by cutting between versions. The cuts actually worked quite well. The tapes weren't very far apart in terms of sound, which was useful. They shouldn't have been, being studio does, but there were sort of little subtle things that were done to the Pick of the Goon stuff, bit of limiting, little bit of equalisation. But the joints worked well enough. And that got the thing out to length, because I was able to get the play out off the TS1 version. And they weren't on the Pick of the Goons versions, with about one exception, I think. There was no actual play out. So that was very nearly the thing at transmission length. So Richard was inclined to say job done. But you see, I wasn't, because there was one line left. And that was the explodable granite statue with built-in plunger, which was originally an explosive granite statue of Bessie Braddock with built-in plunger. Now, of course, by that time, most people have forgotten Bessie Braddock, but Bessie Braddock was quite significant, actually. She was an MP for a seat in Liverpool, Labour, and she was a fierce champion of the underprivileged, and particularly of underprivileged women and children. She was a little uncomfortable for the Labour leadership, even in the 1950s, and the way she went about this. She just did not belt up. And she was about 5 foot nothing and a right battle axe, but a battle axe in a good cause. So, unfortunately, the only tape I had of the complete broadcast was a bit hissy. And the techniques I had available at the time were not brilliant. But I fought that thing as hard as I could, and it was good enough for transmission. So that thing went out a completely length, and of Bessie Braddock, yes, it hisses a bit, but it's there. Now, the later restorations are a lot better because I had different sources, better techniques, all that sort of thing. But that was, I think, my first full-length restoration. And that sort of put me on the map as far as the corporation was concerned, anyway.
Episodes coming in at the wrong length. I do remember when I was writing for the radio, there was a trick that could be used by producers, which is to slow it down or speed it up.
Okay.
Because the thing was then, you see, that in 1991, 92, that corridor was still operating with 1950s technology. All the radio shows were done on quarter-inch tape.
Yeah.
And the editing would be done with a razor blade.
Yeah.
So, say, there's not that many shows that people are still listening to from that point, but say from that point now, but say on the hour. So this was really the first thing that put Armando Nucci and Coogan and Chris Morris kind of on the comedy map. You know, that show was edited together by Armando with a little razor and some tape. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just a simple matter of making the tape go quicker or slower, which is a bit of a cheat. And then, yeah, there's one producer, I won't say who it was, but she did slow down an episode because there was some error and it had come in under length, and so it sort of sounded like the entire thing was done in its sleep, because it was, the actors were talking a little bit slower than they should and all their timing was off because the tape was slowed down. Now, the International Christmas Pudding, they know in the recording that it's under length. So at the end, they stop the theme music and they get Spike Milligan to sing for about 50 seconds.
Yep. Jim Peels. Yep.
And then they explain why he had to sing for 50 seconds. So there's no subterfuge here. And luckily, getting Spike Milligan to sing for 50 seconds is just fun.
Yeah.
So it actually makes it a really good ending. I think that the show has a good ending anyway.
It does.
Not all of them do, and sometimes they just don't think of an ending, and it's just like they just tell the audience, well, you know, you think up your own ending here, or there isn't really an ending.
We're off now. Good night.
And there's one yeah. episode, I can't remember which one it was, it just goes, oh, for the payoffs of yesteryear.
Yes. Yes.
This one has a payoff. Yes. Where it turns out that and Seacombe gets it. And it turns out that this pudding, which has been hunted by everyone for the entire episode, is then eaten by Neddy Seagoon while he is underneath a silver dish, thus thwarting the villains. It's very short and very satisfying, and it's I think one of the better Goon Show endings. And I think the ones which have a little ending, a decent ending, are in the end I prefer, because it's just nice to have a story.
Yes.
And I don't mind them if they don't have a proper ending. I mean, I think the dreaded batter pudding hurler of Bexhill on Sea doesn't, as far as I recall, doesn't really have a proper ending. No. Or it might be one of those ones that gives you two alternative endings.
It does, actually, that one, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Spike wrote this on his own. Very often it's the shows that he wrote with Eric Sykes or Larry, even Larry Stevens,
yeah,
to a lesser degree. They'd have a proper, or more of a structure. Spike's solo scripted shows tended to just peter out at the end. And at the beginning, sometimes in the middle. But, you know, the endings were often a problem. But no, this is a decent, satisfying ending, definitely. The first ending, because like you say, there's kind of an unofficial second ending, isn't there, with Jim Pills. And also, Sabrina fans, this is the first episode to reference Sabrina. Were you aware of Sabrina, Andy?
Not particularly, no. I can't remember the importance of Sabrina.
They mentioned Sabrina with a beard. Now, Sabrina was like, I don't know, poor man's Jane Mansfield, poor man's Dinah Dawes, even. She was a bosomy, although she had weird sort of conical breasts, or at least the
women all did in the 50s.
The brassiere that she wore. But she was, she was doing things like Double Your Money with Huey Green on television. And she was regularly referenced during this period of the Goon Show. Because I think, I've said this before, Spike had a bit of a thing for ladies of a certain build.
Right.
I love the sequence where they talk about the stores for the expedition.
On Blood-Nock's advice, I also purchased the following vital equipment.
One knee-action self-reciprocating Christmas pudding gun.
One hand-painted inflatable Christmas pudding decoy with rubber holly.
One portable plastic and gravel road.
One long bent thing with a sort of lump on the end.
One waterproof cover for the same.
One same.
33 boxes of yellow kosher boots.
Another long bent thing with a sort of lump on the end.
One uncooked leather trilby with sugar feather.
One 60-foot explodable granite statue of Bessie Braddock with built-in plunger.
Detailed plans of what to do with long bent thing with sort of lump on the end.
This is eerie. It's like a bit of a different show. And it's where various characters, including, I think, Gripipe Finn and Moriarty and Seagoon, just list the stores that they're... And it's done in a very deadpan way.
Yep.
And they go, a long thing with a sort of lump on the end. Milligan especially is doing them in a really sort of almost documentary style.
Yeah.
And listening to it today, I thought, is this like referencing a documentary or something that's just been on telly?
Is this
style taken from somewhere else?
Maybe, but I was thinking, you know, is it just taken from a film adaptation of, I don't know, Rider Haggard story or something, where they very earnestly list everything that they need for their journey?
I mean, it's a great bit because it's when it goes into the what was it? And let me find it. The description of instructions for what to do with a long bent thing with a sort of lump on the end. It's sort of at the start, it doesn't have any jokes, and it builds its jokes very nicely in that bit.
It does.
But there's one more thing probably I wanted to mention.
Sure.
As I scatter over my notes here. And I don't know if this is the first episode or not where they start saying, I don't wish to know that. Because there's quite a lot of Goon shows around this time where they just pepper in the phrase, I don't wish to know that, all the time.
Well, that's taken from music hall routines.
Yes. Well, specifically in this one, because they're referencing music hall routines.
Yeah.
So it's I looked this up because I knew that someone must have originated it. So you'll know this, I'm sure. But it was a double act called Marion Mooney.
Marion Mooney, yeah.
Who around in the early decades of the 20th century,
yeah,
who apparently invented the I say, I say, I say, and then the joke, and then I don't wish to know that. Kindly leave the stage at the end. Apparently they invented that, and then it became something that people parodied and everything. I think in this show, where it is in a bit where early on, where Neddy Seagoon says he'll leave his fortune to a home for a second-rate music hall comedians. But that second-rate is in there. You know, that's a little bit of a jab. And yeah. then Moriarty and a grit pipe thin do jokes. And Moriarty does a joke. What has 8 wheels and flies? 2 corporation dust carts. Which is a really odd way to tell like the functional joke, which is what has 4 wheels and flies? A corporation well, dust cart. But Moriarty
They've done that gag before in series 5.
Yeah. So Moriarty tells it wrong. But it is. I think this is the young blades as they are at this point.
Mm.
Being a little bit sneery about the comedians of a previous generation. I remember my lot doing this in the 90s. we thought that the people that were making comedy in the 80s were dreadfully earnest. Where we were kind of like much, much newer and more cynical and more funny.
Well, there was a Savage on. You mentioned Amanda Iannucci and On the Hour. Mm. So the radio forerunner of the day to day. Was it the first episode of On the Hour where they did a Savage takedown of "I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue"?
Earlier on Saturday at 12:25, there's a special 3-hour edition of "I'm Sorry, I Have to Appear in This Programme."
Right, Graham and Barry's team. You have to sing "The Girl from Ipanema," but Barry has to sing every third word and Graham has to sing all the others. But Barry has to sing "Counterpane" for all the words and Graham, you have to sing "Bottom" instead, OK? Go.
Bottom, bottom,
counterpane.
Bottom, bottom,
counterpane.
Bottom.
Which, you know, is continues to be a really funny show. That's pretty harsh.
Mm.
But you know, Chris Morris doesn't give a damn who.
Well, I think it was maybe having a go is too strong. Maybe it was just maybe an affectionate dig.
So maybe there's a little bit more dig than some would have done. It's still a pretty bold thing to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is very common, I think, in comedy or any sphere of life, but certainly in comedy, is that you sort of think that the people who are that you're replacing or you want to replace are in some way old hat. And of course they may only be 10 years older than you. In your mind, they're of a different generation. When you get a bit older, and other people are trying to kick you out of the way, then you know, you find that you're one of the old guard. This happened to, of course, everyone involved with the Goons. But at this point, they're the young blades. They've only really been on the radio for what, about 3 years at this point. They're still pretty fresh.
Four years.
And they're still, and this is a top show now that they've got. It took them like a little couple of years to really hit their stride. All the shows that we don't have, I don't really know much about. You know, I know that Benteen was in them, and his character was called Osric Pureheart, and he was sort of in the middle in the way that. But you know, I don't know. But now they know that they've got it now. They are now in their imperial phase. And they all do variety theatre. They've all come from that background too. So they've met those old comedians. They've been on the same bill as old guys coughing up like years of cigar smoking, going, I say. And so as it got to that bit, I could just imagine kind of like when they're at the Windmill Theatre in the late 40s, Seacombe and Milligan kind of rolling their eyes when one of these old guys comes on and his timing's all gone.
Well,
and they go, we're different.
Well,
we're
Milligan cool. regarded the Goons, or Milligan regarded his comedy as year zero for British comedy.
Mm.
Everything else that came before was, you know.
Yeah, but he's certainly happy to show his contempt here.
Yeah.
He's flashing his contempt, and then they brought out in quite a lot of Goon shows around this time the phrase I don't wish to know that, because he can sort of say that after anything.
Yeah.
So they would just say it as a in their character voices as a way to just to crack each other up.
Yeah. Shorthand to each other. Yeah, in jokes almost.
Mm.
Yeah. Brilliant. So Andy, is there? We've covered a lot of ground and covered stuff that I wasn't expecting as well.
Yes, you'll need to shorten this one down. We've been yakking away for an hour and a half.
That's not normal length.
Oh, no, we haven't covered one thing. You haven't asked me about the music. You have to ask people if they skip the music.
Oh, do you? Right. Okay. So, yeah. Are you a purist? Do you listen to the shows as intended, or do you skip the
When I got into the Goon Show in the end of the 80s, because I was getting the tapes from the library, I'd make my own copies. Home taping is killing music and all of that. But I'd record my Goon Shows. And I found that if you took the music off, you could fit two Goon Shows onto one side of a C90 cassette. I won't be the only person to have said that to you.
No.
So yeah, then you're happy to miss it out. I'll skip Gale Drake because I don't particularly like the sound of it. And I'm much more likely to listen to Ray Ellington because it's just a better sound. They're a good band. And they actually play really well. Whereas, Geldray, I don't know. Oh, do you know the connection between the Goon Show and Veep? As Quantic told you this one?
No.
I'm taking it. You don't. It's to do with Max Geldray. Oh, you don't know this?
No, I don't.
Oh, this is good. You'll like this. So the show Veep on HBO.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is a lot of the people who did. The Thick of It did that show. It's kind of like, it's as close to an American version of The Thick of It as you're going to get. It doesn't continue the same universe, similar style. So same writers, same producer, which is Armando for the first three or four years. Same editors, same directors.
Julia
Louis-Dreyfus.
That's it, yeah.
But all of the people writing the show for the first 4 years were British.
Yeah.
And me and Kevin wrote on series three and series four. So we were brought in as like extra pairs of hands when they were a little bit shorthanded for a little while on season three and season four. And we stuck around for 2 years. There was something that happened in the first season. So this was, I don't know, 2011, something like that. So this show is set in Washington. It's about the vice president. That changes a bit later on. Reasonably big show for HBO, and it's why I've got an Emmy on the shelf. I got that from that show.
Yeah.
As did David Quantic.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I've seen it.
Show set in Washington about American politics.
Yeah.
So lots of names are mentioned of characters that you never see. So there is a mention of a congressman or a senator or something, and so a name was written into the script. Is it Max? Max, whoever it was, someone just made up a name.
Yeah.
All names in a TV show have to then get checked by a lawyer who checks to see if there is anyone vaguely comparable who you might be sort of referencing or libeling. Obviously, this is very important in America, where it's a very litigious culture. So if you create a name of a politician and you're saying that they're a little bit bad or something, and then someone says, "Oh no, sorry. There's someone in is a local politician in Ohio has that name."
Yeah,
you've got to pick a different name.
Yeah.
So the Max whoever was found to exist. So then someone in the writers' room, I don't know who it was. It might have been Simon Blackwell. I don't know, but everybody was British. Said, "Okay, Max Geldray," and everybody laughs. So Max Geldray is mentioned as an American politician in the series V.
Brilliant.
I was, and when I watched the first series, I was so taken with this because I knew exactly where it had come from.
He'd have been dead by then, of course, wouldn't he?
So. Very, very dead. Well, obviously, they'd have come back and said, well, because there'd be no possibility for confusion with the dead harmonica player.
No.
So it was considered not to be a problem. So then Max Geldray is a non... Or someone with that name is a character that you don't see in Veep.
Wow.
I was so taken with this that when we did season four, I think, there's an episode called East Wing. And Tony Hale won his Emmy for his performance in that episode. He does an amazing performance as the character of Gary. And he got a performance for a monologue that me and Kev wrote. I think he got his Emmy for that. He did it so well. And he lists some things in it, and one of them is the character of Geldray. He mentions Geldray
Brilliant.
because of Max Geldray. So in a funny way, Max Geldray won an Emmy. Won somebody an Emmy some years later.
Wow, that's wonderful.
I may have taken too long to tell that story, but it's basically Max Geldray is in Veep.
Hey, listen, Andy, this has been enlightening.
Oh, thank you.
Fascinating.
It's been very enlightening. I've learned absolutely tons. But yeah, I've got aside from the fact that you've got like more material than you can ever use. I've got to literally go back to the drawing board now. I've got cartoons to do.
Oh well, okay. What
and
before
a
you go
of Christmas.
Before you go, well, tell me about Seize Them. Seize Them.
Oh yeah, well, I should plug that, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Seize Them is a medieval comedy which I wrote during the lockdowns in 2020 and 2021. And I thought, okay, there's no way this is going to get made. But I'm just going to write exactly the film I want to see. And then I've just got it out of my system. And then it went and got made really quickly. I think, which is the last thing I expected to happen. It stars Amy Lou Wood out of Sex Education as a queen in the Dark Ages called Queen Dagon, who loses her kingdom. And she has to go on the run and try to get her kingdom back or become a better person or choose between those things. So it's a comedy adventure.
Brilliant.
And about a queen who loses her kingdom. And it's also got Lolly Adefope and Nick Frost and Nicola Coughlan and Jessica Hines in the big roles.
Is it kind of Princess Bride vibes to it at all?
Or? Well, that's more of a child-friendly movie. This is like a 15.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
So it's a bit violent and a bit sweary.
Fair enough.
You know, maybe it's more of a sort of a grown-up Frozen or a slightly more grown-up Princess Bride. The thing is, there's not that many medieval comedies. That's one of the reasons I knew it would never get made. Because people always writing them because they really want to make them. And they never get made. This one did. So it's going to be out. The release was held up for various reasons this year, as often happens.
Yeah.
For reasons large and small, I won't go into. That no one could really help. But it's now going to be released in 2024. I hope in the first half of. But I don't know exactly when. I've yet to hear. But it's coming out soon.
Fantastic. We'll look out for that. Andy, it's been a blast. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for letting me on it. It's been lovely.